Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music Documentaries.
Matt Everett's The First Time with Slash.
Hello and welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is where we meet some of the most influential figures in music and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. This week's guest is without doubt one of the most instantly recognisable guitarists in rock and a man responsible for some of the greatest riffs of all time. Born in the UK as Saul Hudson, he went on to epitomise a certain kind of rock star lifestyle and career. Millions of records sold and audiences played to, thousands of hotels trashed and bottles of JD drunk. A man known worldwide by just one name, Slash. Born in London and raised in Stoke-on-Trent, the young Slash would eventually make Los Angeles his home, and it was there that he joined Guns N' Roses as their lead guitarist. GNR would go on to become one of the biggest bands on the planet, responsible for classic tracks like Paradise City, November Rain, and that one you just heard, Welcome to the Jungle, all shot through with Slash's trademark Gibson Les Paul guitar sound. Here, Slash talks about his childhood and a youth obsessed by rock music, as well as the massive success of Guns N' Roses, their near mythical excess, and the collapse and eventual split of the band. He also remembers how he emerged from the wreckage of the group and dealt with his own addictions to find success with new bands like Velvet Revolver and Slash's Snake Pit, and also his work with musicians like Michael Jackson. And I started by asking Slash, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
Oh, man. I mean, as soon as I can remember. I think the record that sticks with me that was my earliest sort of memory was Moody Blues. Nights in White Satin was on.
Nights in White Satin.
That's a good song.
Yeah, it was a great record, you know. But then along with that, then it was all around the same time. It was Yardbirds and the Stones and the Kinks and the Who. And this is all my dad's music. And this was here in England. And so that was all sort of like the background music to my childhood that I remember distinctly.
So know? It was a very musical household even early on.
Yeah, well, my dad was, he was part of the 60s sort of British tearaway rebellious youth generation.
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
And so rock and roll was sort of the band that he wore on his sleeve, you know. Yeah. I can't say anything for the rest of the household. It's very traditional, old-fashioned English, you know, Stoke and Trent kind of, you know. He was the tearaway for sure.
Why don't you all fade away? Don't try to dig what we all say. What we all try to cause a big sensation. Just talking about my generation. Cause we get around.
What about the first record that was yours, that you owned, that you bought?
I want to say it was Led Zeppelin 1. There was a lot of records that all happened at the same time, but that's the one that I think was probably the first one. And I remember because my mom and dad had it from years on, or years before. And when I was in my teen years and started really discovering rock and roll for myself, I remember going back and getting that record again. Yeah.
Tell us about the love of Zepp then. What is it about them that you found yourself just kind of drawn towards?
Zeppelin was you know, they were harder edged, you know, and I always loved that, and really rhythmic and basically heavy. Definitely had a mesmerizing kind of a groove. There was an ambience to Zeppelin that was unique unto themselves, you know. And I always really liked them. I always liked the guitar playing. I always liked, especially the drumming. I think that was the key thing for me, was the drums were so sexy.
I'm
a couple of days before she was rid of me. She swore that she would be all mine and love me till the end. But when I whispered in her ear, I lost another friend.
I presume that was seeing the kind of Les Paul Marshall combo that Jimmy Page had. That must have had an impression on you, because that's kind of what you play to this day.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when I first decided to pick up the guitar, the first guitar that I got was a Memphis Les Paul copy. And I remember, you know, like, I didn't technically know anything about, I hadn't done any of that homework, so I didn't technically know guitar from, you know, guitars from each other or what made them different and so on. And I've always liked the aesthetic of a Les Paul, definitely. And so Jimmy Page, I saw pictures of Eric Clapton, Mike Bloomfield, Keith Richards, Pete Townsend. So all those guys had Les Pauls. And I definitely identified with Les Paul over a Strat right from the very beginning. And so from that first guitar, you know, after that guitar was a copy and it didn't last for very long. And so I did go through a period of trial and error with all kinds of different brands of electric guitars and ended up back at a Les Paul. And I really stopped mucking around with it after that.
So what about first gig then? What was the first gig that you went to?
My first real gig, say in a proper club, was a place called Al's Bar. And I was jamming with Stones, Beatles, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, you know, Creedence Clearwater cover band.
That's a good list of bands.
Very funky, just doing it for the beer kind of guys, you know, not career minded at all at that point. Really good band. And I got up and jammed with them. That was my first real gig. Prior to that, I played, you know, a bunch of, keg parties.
that's for the English people. That's just a beer party.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew that was going to, I was wondering if there was going to be a question mark for that one. But yeah, I mean, I played a bat mitzvah, you know, I played.
What was that like?
It was actually, there's a really funny story that goes with the bat mitzvah. I was commissioned basically to do this gig by the girl whose bat mitzvah it was. And she said, yeah, come down to my parents' house. We're really rich. Mick Jagger's going to be there and you guys come and play. And so we said, cool. And I can't remember how much we were getting paid, but any money was a lot of money at the time. And so we packed everything up into my friend's pickup truck and we drove all the way down there. And it was really, you know, a very sort of traditional Jewish family oriented bat mitzvah. Mick Jagger was nowhere to be seen. We got so drunk at this thing the night before and they put us in the guest house and we destroyed this guest house. We broke the sink. We threw up in the stew. People peed in the pool. And the next morning we're all hungover and we get up and the people that arrive are all her relatives and like cousins, uncles, aunts, you know, grandparents. And they're very, like I said, very, you know, sort of a traditional Jewish setup. And the band that they were expecting was going to be sort of a very, you know, sort of mellow, playing sort of top 40 covers kind of thing. So we got up there and we played like Deep Purple and Zeppelin and, you know, Jimi Hendrix stuff at like ear-splitting volume, and they were not happy about it. That was, yeah, that was one of my early gigs.
One of her early bands was called Road Crew, yeah, which is...
Yeah, that actually was Road Crew.
So that's named after Motorhead's song.
Yeah, it was.
What have you always... Can you remember the first time you heard Motorhead? Because that's different to Zep. There's a whole different rock thing going on there. That's like a punk energy.
It's like punk heavy metal. It's great. It's still one of my... I mean, Motorhead is probably the band that really did that as early on as they did and as original as they did, better than anybody else that came afterwards. And still to this day are still the best. Ace of Spades was the first Motorhead record I remember getting. And I think I got turned on to it by Izzy. I think Izzy's the one from Guns N' Roses was the one that turned me on to that album. And I don't think I'd heard the song Ace of Spades prior to that, but I didn't hear the whole record until Izzy had it.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
In terms of Guns N' Roses, when was the first...
This is a very complicated question.
Time. No, all right, tell you what. First impressions of Axl, a man who was...
No, that's I won't even go there.
You won't even go there?
let's say the first time that I met him. I'm pretty sure the first time I ever set eyes on Axl was... There was an ad that those guys had in the Recycler, which was like the local... you know, where you buy and sell stuff and you put ads in for different things.
Exchange of mark.
Yeah. Anyway, and so I answered this ad and I went to this little, I went to this house where they had sort of like a back room, and Axel and Izzy both were there. And that's the first time that we actually met. And then months after that, I ran into Axel at a, nothing came out of that first meeting. And I ran into Axel again at a barbecue joint on Sunset and Crescent Heights, very famous place called Harry's Open Pit Barbecue. And I didn't speak to him, but I recognized him. And then after that, Steven Adler and I went to a place called Guzzari's, and he had dragged me over there to go see these guys that were supposedly a really good singer, because we were looking for a singer, and it turned out it was Axel and Izzy. And so, you know, at that point, you know, you knew something was going to happen.
There's the legend of how those early gigs kind of appeared to the rest of the world. It was the Sunset Strip, and there was the Roxy, and the Whiskey, and this incredibly exciting time with girls, clubs, and drinking, and going out, and this band slowly starting to gather pace. Is the legend true? Is that how it felt? Did it start to build?
I don't know about. I mean, I think in hindsight, it probably seems more exciting than living it.
And more romantic, yeah, because it seems very romantic.
Yeah. I mean, it is when you look at it from a distance. It does have a very classic sort of like Cinderella coming together of all these different guys. And I was very apprehensive about doing anything with Axel at this point because I'd already had an experience with him, and so Izzy and I hooked up, and so next thing you know, we started something, and we decided that we were going to do a road trip to Seattle, to the Pacific Northwest, and we're going to do gigs all along the way and then come back. And we did a gig in LA, and then we packed up and headed to Seattle, but the car broke down, so we hitchhiked, all five of us. And that was the glue that really made the first real Guns N' Roses a real thing, you know, that sort of camaraderie of going through that trip together.
So the first thing that actually came out, the first Guns N' Roses release, was Live Like a Suicide, and some original stuff and some covers. Aerosmith was one of the covers. Mm. We have to talk about Aerosmith because they're a band that loom large in your life, definitely. What is it about?
I think, Aerosmith for me, when I first picked up the guitar, when I first heard the Aerosmith Rocks record, it screamed at me. It was like
it was for you.
Finding the long lost whatever it was in my, you know. And the thing about Aerosmith at the time is I was always a big Stones fan and always a big Zeppelin fan, and they managed to put those styles together and have a very sort of blues based Stonesy kind of a thing with a lot of Zeppelin-y type riffs and very sort of in your face loud and very sort of sleazy and drunken kind of you know, and that I identified with, and that really sort of set me in the direction that I ended up going.
Which Aerosmith track should we play now?
Back in the South.
That was Back in the Saddle by Aerosmith.
Six Music.
Six.
Oh,
Welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, guitar legend Slash. And that was, of course, Paradise City from Guns N' Roses' first album, Appetite for Destruction. We have to talk about the first Guns N' Roses album, Appetite for Destruction, 1987. I'm really fascinated by what happens when a group of individuals or a group of musicians, who, let's face it, aren't normal members of society, when a group of musicians get that much attention and adulation and fame and money, how it feels to be in the centre of that. Because it was a staggeringly successful record.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you cope?
Well, I mean, I can only speak on my own behalf. Yeah, yeah. I think everybody had different coping issues with that. For me, it just made me, I'm already sort of an introverted type, you know, sort of keep to myself. But when that happened, that really drove me underground because my aspirations obviously were to make a great record and play concerts. And we did that. We didn't really break it big until we'd been out for about 2 years, as far as the record was released. And prior to that, we were just a club band. So for those 2 years, we were an opening band. Not everybody knew who we were. And we were building up this following, this underground following that we weren't even aware of. And we were finally, I think, opening for Aerosmith when people were starting to show up to the gigs early. And that was all the recognition I needed in that context, live on stage, and that was it. But when it came to what you call massive public appeal, you know, and being recognized on the street, I didn't know how to handle it. So I really became a recluse, and I didn't really enjoy it. I still don't enjoy fame for fame's sake, but I love being able to play for a big audience. And I love the fact that there is that connection that you have with a lot of people and the music connection and all that. But the whole dynamic of just being sort of famous when you're walking down the street is not what I got into this for. You know, so that was always a big, that was the crux of a lot of my problems back in those days.
What's your relationship like with the songs on that album now? Because
I still play them.
There's some big songs. I mean, often people, you know, so you got stuff like Welcome to the Jungle and Paradise City, songs that will be played many, many years long after you're gone, you know, which is a testament to how great they are. Often that can kind of be a bit of a weight. I mean, do you still enjoy playing them?
Since I've been touring around on my own, sort of like as a solo guy, even though I've pretty much established a new band at this point, but it was all instigated by sort of my solo, recent solo career kind of thing. And it was the first time in years that I've actually gone back and played old Guns N' Roses songs. And it's great. I mean, the songs themselves they were great then, and they're still great, you know, so I enjoy playing them. And the crowd, by and large, digs hearing them, you know, so.
Can you remember when drugs started to become an issue with you, or substance abuse started to become an issue and started maybe getting in the way of doing the performing, the good stuff, the musician stuff?
I mean, I don't think that it really, for me, became... I think I had a within reason, a decent handle on it. All through the early years of Guns N' Roses, I mean, for us, right?
For someone else, it might have been a problem. Yeah. We were okay with it.
For us, it worked out fine. And I think it started to present itself as an issue after I quit the band. And I was really just sort of a free agent, sort of with no particular career ambition other than just playing guitar. But I didn't have a focus on where I was going or what I wanted to do. And I was really relieved to have gotten out of that whole sort of situation. So I was just partying really hard. And that went on from, I was partying really hard anyway. But then it took on a whole new, you know, partying really hard took on a whole new meaning from, say, 96 up until about 2001. Where I think it was really turned into substance abuse to the point of really addicted kind of a thing. Yeah.
You were young and your heart was an open book. You used to say, live and let live. This ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry. Say, live and let die.
You mentioned about leaving the band there. It did seem to turn into this, especially the Use Your Illusion tour, which is like a 2-year tour.
Yeah, it was difficult.
It became, that tour itself is kind of famous for late showings and enormous
That's when all that,
entourages yeah. and masseuses and parties before, after and during. Was that one of the things that kind of made you think, I'm done here?
It was hard. Let's just put it that way. I don't think I had any, I don't think I really... you know, made a firm decision to leave or anything, but that 3 years of that particular tour, which is a 3-year tour, it was like a record, was great. It should have been, you know, the best time. I mean, we really had arrived and the best possible place you could be for a rock band. But it was just so difficult because of the things that you were mentioning. So when it was over, I think that's when it was over, it was really just like trying to decompress. And then
how do you decompress off the song?
I started another band and I went on the road in a sort of more sort of small club kind of thing and just sort of revisited why I do what I do and what really makes it great, you know, which was just the sort of just enjoying playing and playing for an audience and the simplicity of it, because it was so convoluted and so complex it in Guns N' Roses prior to that. And I thought, you know, I get that out of my system. And then I went back and realized it was worse than it ever was. And I think it was a lot of it had to do with the fact that I'd lost a couple of the key members. And that was really crucial to how the band worked, you know, how it functioned and how it survived.
I'm also interested because there's a kind of weird link-up. Because I remember at the time when Nevermind came out, when Nirvana's Nevermind came out, and lots of critics and lots of people kind of used it as a stick to kind of beat Guns N' Roses. Yeah. And that whole genre of music, pretty hard yeah. with. It was kind of, that's over, it's done, it's done. And I want to know how you felt when you kind of first heard Nirvana. Because you went on to, you've recorded with Dave Grohl, you've covered a Nirvana track with Velvet Revolver. But do you remember hearing sort of Nirvana for the first time and going, oh, this is different?
Well, I mean, I think in the early 90s, Soundgarden and Alice in Chains were the first bands that I got into. And then Nirvana came along, and I remember Axl took me to go see them. At the Palace in Los Angeles one night. And I was like, yeah, you know, whatever. To me, it was great that there was just rock bands that were, like, any good. And that was basically my take on it. I thought the records were good, and it was all very positive. So the issues that had to do with Guns N' Roses were entirely internal. Had nothing to do with Nirvana. We were still, like, you know, playing sold-out stadiums and stuff. So the demise of Guns N' Roses had nothing to do with grunge, if that's what people were trying to say, you know. But we did timely break up around that time. So,
what about Soundgarden? You mentioned, I mean, an astonishing band, still an astonishing, a reformed astonishing band. Yeah. What would be a song of theirs we should?
Well, when I first got turned on to them, it was an EP that they had. I can't remember what the EP was called, but the song itself was "Big Dumb Sex," which I was just, who the hell is this? You know. So that would be my first real experience with Soundgarden. I fell in love with them from that point on.
You start to play with some amazing people around that point. You know, you start to do some really interesting guest appearances and stuff. Tell me about Michael Jackson. Not many people say they played with Michael Jackson. When did you first meet him?
I first met Michael. He called me at the Riot House in Hollywood. And it's sort of funny because I got a phone call. You know, I'm with some girl. We're in a hotel room and we're hanging out and the shades are all drawn. And we've been in there for like 3 days. And I get this phone call from my manager saying Michael Jackson is looking to get in touch with you. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm like, well, I guess, yeah, I'll take the call. So 10 minutes later, the phone rings. And it's Michael. And it's that, you know, that voice, which, you know, you've seen or heard in TV and all that and on the radio. And he asked, told me what he was doing. He's making this album if I'd like to play on it. But in that sort of sweet Michael tone, it was very sort of surreal. And we set a date to meet up at the record plant in the next couple days or something. So I went down to the record plant and Michael was there with Brooke Shields because that was when they were dating at that time, right?
Okay.
And he gave me free rein in the studio. We met, we exchanged niceties. I met Brooke. He left me with the producer and said, you know, here's this song that we're working with. Can you do something with it? And then he took off. And so I spent the rest of the night putting guitars on a song called Give In To Me. And then a couple days later, they called me in to do another session, which turned out to be the intro to Black or White. Now, I never actually played on the song Black or White, which is, everybody thinks that I'm the one playing guitar on that. But unfortunately, I was just not knowing what, I was given this sort of opportunity to do something, but there was no guidelines, so I didn't know what to play. At this particular day, there was no music for me to play on. So they're just like, play, you know? And in a room full of people staring at you, I really didn't know what to play or feel comfortable playing. And at some point, I was fing around with my guitar getting sounds or something, and they recorded that, and that became the intro to Black or White.
Velvet Revolver, this is another big band who, I mean, if I say Against the Odds became a success, I'm not talking about your talent, I'm talking about the kind of people expecting it to be, oh, it's a super group, it's going to do okay, but you know, it's just the names, and became much bigger than that, became a band that people really loved.
Mm. It was really just to have a band. It wasn't about a super group, it wasn't looking for
no big
any
plan.
Kind of massive success or anything like that. It was just a handful of guys just looking to play rock and roll, and we all happen to know each other really well, but we're all sort of pseudo high profile guys. And so we auditioned singers, I remember, for like 10 months straight.
10 months?
We listened to singers, like 200 singers a day for like 6 days a week for like 10 months. It was exhausting. And it was you know, so you'd, at the end of the week, you just wanted to put a gun to your head. But we stuck with it. And then all those guys, I didn't know Scott Weiland, but, and so his name popped up eventually, you know, reached out to him, and eventually he came down, and we should have known right then. He had a lot of baggage at that time.
What do you mean by baggage?
I think the thing was, is, you know, Duff and I had been there before, so we thought we could help this guy and sort of get him through this thing. And he seemed genuinely interested in trying to clean up his act and whatnot. Anyway, so we started working with Scott, and we recorded a couple songs together, and next thing you know, Velvet Revolver. We'll be right back.
In 2008, you appeared on the soundtrack to The Wrestler with Clint Mansell for Darren Aronofsky's fantastic film. Something very different for you. You've always loved movies and you've done bits of soundtrack stuff before, haven't you? It's a beautiful piece of music.
Well, I didn't, you know, Darren called me up, and Darren Aronofsky's obviously one of the great directors of our time, and Clint is his guy. And so I went down and met with Clint, and he'd actually written the music, but he wanted me to perform it, is what it was. So it was really sort of a very textured, very simple, sparse kind of a thing, but I really enjoyed working with those guys. And then after that, I've done some more scoring, and I'm scoring again now because I've got a production company that's doing horror movies, and I've got a movie in production that I'm getting ready to write music for. I'm actually writing music now, but we're going to start recording pretty soon.
What's it going to sound like?
Well, it's actually the movie's a horror movie. It's a very scary sort of demon-based religious kind of a thing. So that's where I'm at right this minute.
You seem to be in a really good place right now, man. You seem really happy.
Yeah, well, I'm free of, you know, unnecessary anxieties. I just have the stuff that everybody goes through, which is fine. I don't have a lot of unnecessary baggage that I have to navigate. So it's been really a good time. Last few years have been great.
And the final thing we do is we get you to pick the last track. What should we get? It can be anything of yours, anything new, anything old, a song you've loved from your past. It's just going to be the final song.
That's way too broad.
I know.
I'm promoting my own record, so I'll play something off my own record. Let's see. There's a song on the record that I haven't actually played before called Shots Fired, so let's play that.
Why that one?
It's just a really cool song, and I haven't played it
before. Good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Good talking to you, too.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Where I am a desert.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.
I'm the preacher. A done decision. The creature has lost its vision.